Good morning.
In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world. And you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind. Mankind, that word should have new meaning for all of us today. We can't be consumed by our petty differences anymore. We will be united in our common interest. Perhaps it's fate that today is the 4th of July, and you will once again be fighting for our freedom. Not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. We're fighting for our right to live, to exist. And should we win the day, the 4th of July will no longer be known as an American holiday, but as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to live on. We're going to survive. Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
Everyone, welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM. I forgot our call sign for a minute. Not great. 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
I think Peter has just sort of roused by the stirring words of Bill Pullman on the eve of the alien counterattack 22 years ago on this day.
That's wild. It was only 22 years ago. It feels like yesterday to me.
It really does, doesn't it? End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the somewhat disturbing, maybe, action drama, Sicario, Day of the Soldado. And that is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including Watchmen. The seminal graphic novel is going to be coming back as an HBO series with some impressive casting. But can Damon Lindelof succeed where some people say Zack Snyder did not? And then Matt Groening is launching a new animated series on the Netflix. It's called Disenchanted, and the first teaser was just released. And what is that going to tell us about what to expect from the show? And then finally, Jared Leto is going to be in another comic book movie, but how does one prepare in the method style to play a mad scientist who's turned into a vampire? I think even Jared Leto's met his match on that one in terms of just, you know, method acting, but I don't know. We'll see. But first, and I don't think we got a chance to weigh in. I don't think we got a chance to weigh in on this. On this show or the other show I do, Open Sources Golf, which is more politics-based anyway, but I felt the occasion arise again because Jerry Seinfeld was doing an interview on in promotion of his next season of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Mm-hmm. We have a fan.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Okay, good.
Sounds great.
I haven't seen too terribly much of it, but...
It depends on the person that's in his car with him, right? It's one of those types of shows.
Jerry Seinfeld and Jay Leno are both like old guys who love cars way too much, in my opinion. I love
coffee, though. See, that's why I like it. They go to great coffee places.
All right. I guess to each his own. So he was being interviewed, and he was talking about Roseanne Barr, who was fired from her... Well, I guess they canceled the whole show after she made some disgusting statements about Valerie Jarrett, who was a former advisor to former President Barack Obama. And Seinfeld said something interesting. He said, you know, she's already dead. You don't murder someone who's committing suicide. And I think what he's talking about there, she's not literally dying, but she's committing, I don't know, career suicide, humanity yeah. suicide, which, I think I know what he's talking about, but at the same time, it's...
Well, I don't know if she was dead. Like, she, right. I guess, died in one day because of the tweet, but, like, Roseanne, the show, was booming, right? It opened yeah. with what? How many viewers the first one? Like
22 yeah, million or something. 22 which million? Is, like, in the current broadcast climate is pretty huge.
Yeah, but after her tweet, she was also all over the news, right? But mm-hmm. in a negative way, but she was still famous, so I don't think her... What Jerry Seinfeld said about her not being famous, being, you know, dead career-wise, makes it so she shouldn't have gotten fired.
Yeah, and
I think NBC, it was NBC, right? Roseanne, ABC. I think they made the right protocol by firing her.
Yeah, and I think what I remember is everybody was surprised that they fired her or that they canceled the show.
I was just surprised because I thought she had the main rights to the show. NBC probably did have some trouble canceling it first.
She's a... if not the creator, the co-creator of the show, which means she gets...
She's probably still making bank through it.
Well, I think... because they're proceeding with a spinoff called The Conners, mm-hmm. which is everybody but Roseanne. And they're going full speed ahead with that. And I think that was mostly a measure to basically save the show and save the jobs and save all the hard work of mm-hmm. the people who are taking part in the show. But... I think in order to make that happen, she had to give up. I'm not 100% sure, but I think she had to give up some of her
it would have lost financial. So many viewers. And there would have been protests and things like that.
If she had stayed on.
Yeah, if they had made a second yeah. season with her still as the central character.
Oh, for sure. The thing I don't... And this goes into Jerry Seinfeld's point is, you know, she's been heading this way for a while. And mm-hmm. a lot of people forget that she was in a video where she was dressed as Hitler putting human-shaped cookies into the oven.
Yep.
Which is a little on the nose.
Oh, she's been pretty pretty wild for a long time. Yeah. And the Roseanne character was quite conservative in the first seasons, too. So I don't know why that...
Like, they were like middle class.
Yeah.
Or working class.
Everyday
white people.
And
right.
Trump won, so the average amount of people did, you know, vote for him. So I don't think... A lot of people were upset about that when it came to Roseanne before it was canceled, before she was canceled from her own show. But I don't think that was such a major issue. But I think her tweeting and making a racist comment was that's her crossing the line.
Right. It's
And when it comes to Seinfeld, I don't think he should have made a comment on it. But I don't think he realizes how famous he still is. Because there was that Kesha thing late last year, too, where right. she went for a little hug and he just, like, pushed her away. And I guess he never realizes that it's going to be all over in the news. Like, literally the most famous show or one of the most famous shows of all time is his last name.
Yeah.
So I think he just needs to start realizing that and deal with it.
Well, I mean, I think Seinfeld would make the point that it's, you know, he's someone who's speaking his mind, whether he doesn't want to hug somebody or is talking mm-hmm. about another comedian, that, you know, and I think he's one of the comedians who said, like, he doesn't play college campuses anymore because it's too PC.
Yeah, him and Chris Rock.
Yeah. I forgot about that whole Kesha thing, but, I mean, maybe she had watched the series, she would have got the impression that Jerry's not a hugger.
He doesn't want that. Yeah. Yeah.
That he's not one of those, like, hey, how are you?
Yeah.
Rip, you know, I don't know if Uncle Leo's still alive, but I think that's one of the lessons. Anyway, I think the reason the Conners is proceeding is precisely because of the money. People are going to check that out because of the controversy, because she's gone. Mm. Whether or not that, you know, that center holds. Because I remember when Ellen came out of the closet, this was years and years and years ago, and people would watch Ellen for the first time to see that coming out episode. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think this show was canceled the next year because it just went back to being regular.
The way it was, yeah.
So it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens to the Conners.
How many views the next season will get?
Yeah, because the thing that bothered me, I didn't really watch the show, but I saw clips of it and I read a lot about it, and it just seemed like it was like, you know, Trump in kind of name only because, you know, mm-hmm. she has on the show, they have grandchildren who are of mixed race or of, you know, binary gender, and it just seems like, you know.
Yeah, her kids in the newest season were very against her supporting Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's I wonder if, you know, that whole thing was a gimmick to begin with, just to have a central character who's like, yeah, Trump's awesome, just, you know, to get the eyeballs and the libtards riled up. It's, you know, yeah, the trolling stuff. It always seemed a bit of a put-on to begin with.
Yeah. But even if that's the case, like, she's a Trump supporter in real life. So definitely some of the real her was in that character.
Right.
But like I said, for me, it was just the racist comment. Not the Trump thing. I don't think people should have been so upset about that. It was
right. No. Yeah, it was definitely the tweet that slayed the show. Anyway, speaking of shows and maybe even controversial shows, they've been announcing more casting for this Watchmen series that is being supervised by Damon Lindelof. Mm-hmm. Who Damon Lindelof was on the S list for a while because of how Lost ended, and then he co-wrote Prometheus. But, you know, he's kind of bounced back because a lot of people, like, there's a big cult following for The Leftovers. So there's a lot of people looking forward to this. It's not going to be an adaptation of the graphic novel. It's, from what I've gathered in my reading, it's going to be the aftermath of what happened after the end of the graphic novel. Where,
that's cool.
I don't know if it's going to be, like, the way it was done in the movie or the way it was done in the graphic novel.
He just doesn't want to. I think he said he doesn't want to fully... I think he's an Alan Moore fan, right?
Yeah.
And a Watchmen fan. I don't think he wants to hurt Alan Moore's feelings. or I don't think he wants to accidentally ruin something he loves.
I also don't think he wants to get the ire of Alan Moore.
Yeah.
Which can be considerable. Mm-hmm. Alan Moore, who won't even put his name on things that are adapted from Alan Moore materials anymore. Yeah. So
he was like, I remember him being publicly against V for Vendetta when it came out and Watchmen when it came out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think
he's just a wild man.
He's very
eccentric.
And League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We forget.
But I can see why he was mad at that one, though.
No doubt. But so, I mean, already there's this kind of interesting factor of like, what is this show going to look like? And then they go and cast Jeremy Irons this week as like an old British lord. And
the only named character thus far, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a ton of people in the cast. There's Regina King, there's Don Johnson, Tim Blake Nelson, Lewis Gossett Jr., Andrew Howard, Adelaide Clemens, and they also cast this week Tom Misson, who people might remember as Ichabod Crane in the Sleepy Hollow show that started awesome and then went way downhill after that. And, it's interesting because I'd actually forgotten this was happening until they cast Jeremy Irons this week. And then I was like, okay, who would Jeremy Irons play in the graphic novel for the character from the graphic novel? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe he'd be like Old Night Owl or something. But then I was reading on that it was this whole new thing. I think my interest in this went from... not zero necessarily, but pretty low to now I'm interested because I'm one of the rare people who actually like the Watchmen movie.
I really like the Watchmen movie too.
Yeah, and I read the graphic novel beforehand, so
yeah,
I do
same
come
here.
From that world.
I think that's part of it. And then Zack Snyder released on Blu-ray after the 10-hour version where the other part of the Watchmen is included, like just the separate story that the one character in Watchmen is reading.
Right.
So if you're a huge, huge fan of the film, you could watch that.
The pirate story.
Yeah, the pirate story.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that separately. And
but he upset Alan Moore, so I can see why another fan, Damon Lindelof, is not doing that.
Right. I question whether or not Alan Moore really cares at this point, but I'm sure Alan Moore will eventually say something. I mean, because in the comic books, they've incorporated the Watchmen into like the main DC comic book universe. Yeah. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So they've also produced like sequels and prequels to them in the last few years, so... it's been...
he's used to it.
He's used to having the stuff bastardized, basically.
Yeah, or at least a normal person would be used to it. It's Alan Moore, though, so you never know.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it may come to the point where the show comes on and he's like, this is the worst case of taking my ideas I've ever seen. Of course, quite famously, Moore wanted to use the Carlton Comics characters, mm-hmm. but DC wouldn't let him, so he had to make up his own character. So, I mean, even Alan Moore, who also has another big franchise based on stuff he didn't invent. So it's, and also Lost Girls, which is basically a pornographic adventure, yes. with Dorothy and Alice in Wonderland. And so it's
only graphic novel where if you go to Indigo, mm-hmm. it's the only graphic novel that's fully covered in plastic, so you can't look through it in Indigo or Chapters. Because it's, yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to be flipping through that next to the kid who's looking at Spider-Man.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I hear you. It's...
but that's why it's good. It's HBO for Watchmen, right? Because it's right. pretty wild too. So there's going to be a lot of things that are quite common in it, like violence, nudity.
Right, and it makes me wonder because I won't call the original Watchmen misogynistic, but I mean there's like basically the two female characters in mm-hmm. that, and especially the older Silk Spectre is like kind of played as a victim quite a bit, even though she's a superhero. So I wonder if that's maybe one of the things that Lindelof's trying to address by doing like a side story or a different story, mm-hmm. or using the graphic novel to launch into something new. And it's not just reverence for the material, that, you know, there are opportunities to do new and different things beyond just what's on the page and, you know, being locked into that material, because it's a very specific story with a very specific beginning, middle, and end. And, you know, where would you go after the first season? Because I think there's an eye on this being an ongoing thing.
Yeah, there would actually be a lot of places to go if he set it before the graphic novel to Watchmen. You know, old Night Owl, it could just be the regular Night Owl, and, you know, the original Watchmen crew.
Set it in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah. There's a lot he can do.
Yeah.
Even without, you know, it being actually Watchmen.
Okay, well, we've talked me into it.
Mm-hmm. But I just want to say it's a little risky for Damon Lindelof for it to be an HBO show. Like, he's a network guy, right? Like, he knows how to make good network shows, but HBO, it's kind of
well, Leftovers
a bit more.
Wasn't HBO.
Yeah, and then it got good reviews and everything.
Well, the first season got I haven't watched it. But I think the first season got mixed reviews, and the second season and the third season got really good reviews.
So. Okay, good. I just know him through Lost, so that's good. He already does have some non-network show.
Well, speaking of going non-network, we'll play this clip from a new series coming to Netflix.
All right, then.
You've seen the future in Futurama. You've seen the present in Springfield. So, what's the obvious third move? The past, of course. Welcome to Dreamland.
Hear ye, hear ye. Royal Court is now in session.
Let's have a look at this no-good pile of scum. Weak chin, buck teeth, and... Wow!
Hi, Dad.
Disenchantment, August 17th on Netflix.
So, that's all we know.
Yeah, that's just a little teaser. I want some more footage.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. It is called Disenchantment. It's from Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons.
And Futurama.
Mm-hmm. And the log line is, the series follows Bean, an alcoholic princess, her elf companion Elfo, and her personal demon Lucci, who lives in the medieval kingdom of Dreamland. And it's going to premiere on August the 17th, the first 10 episodes on Netflix. And it's, I mean, it kind of looks like
same
fantasy
animation.
Futurama.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the castle that they show in the clip is literally jokingly the exact same outline of the Futurama
the
main
Planet
place.
Express
yeah,
building.
The Planet
yeah.
Express building.
Yeah.
It's just a wood version. That's the only difference.
A wood and stone version. Yeah. And then, yeah.
But that's funny.
Yeah. But it's got all the Futurama. Well, not all the Futurama, but certainly most of the significant voices from Futurama. So John DiMaggio, Billy West, Maurice LaMarche, Tress MacNeille, and David Herman are all mm-hmm. part of the cast. So it seems like Joan DiMaggio is, you know, quoted as saying it's like Simpsons meets Game of Thrones. And I want to explore that a bit in a sec, but it also seems like Futurama meets Game of Thrones, and I'm wondering, who will be the Bender and who will be the Zoidberg, and it just seems like that's where this is kind of going.
I think the Bender will most likely be her little creature that's with her, the
one demon,
that, that Eric Andre voices.
Yeah. Eric Andre is part of the main cast, and so is Nat Faxon, and Abby Jacobson is the princess.
Yeah, Abby Jacobson from Broad City.
Yep.
But her dad in the trailer has the exact same voice as Bender, so her dad could also be very Bender-esque. That'd be cool.
Yeah,
he's a Cane man. Cane's drank a ton of mead. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he could be the Bender character, because that's the Joe DiMaggio's, or John DiMaggio. Mm-hmm. He's the voice of that. So it's, I think it's it looks interesting. The whole when John DiMaggio says it's like meets Game of Thrones, that makes me wonder, like, because it's on Netflix. Because one of the quotes I read was, it's an adult fantasy. So this is graining. It's about life and death, love and sex, and how to keep laughing in a world full of suffering idiots despite what the elders and wizards and other jerks tell you. So the love and sex thing is interesting. So is it in the whole thing, it's like it's an adult fantasy. Mm-hmm. So is it going to be an adult fantasy?
Oh, 100%.
100%.
Yeah, 100%. It's going to be like The Simpsons in Futurama. Or do you mean even more adult than that?
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, you mean explicit.
Swearing and sex and violence and things, like Game of Thrones.
That's right. Futurama and Simpsons, there's no F word or anything. I think it's Netflix, so I think he probably has a bit more freedom than a network channel. So yeah, I hope there's the F word. I don't think Eric Andre would be able to not use the F word. You know?
Maybe. The line makes me curious. And
he also might want to appeal, though, to... people who already do like The Simpsons and Futurama,
right?
And a lot of which are, you know, now adults who are maybe showing their kids, you know, Simpsons and Futurama, and they think this is going to be like that, where it is adult, and I'm using finger quotes, adult, but no F word or nudity or anything.
Right.
And then their, you know, 10-year-old, 12-year-old might see some things they probably shouldn't see.
Yes.
So he might stick to what he's used to. I hope not, though. I hope he takes advantage of it being Netflix.
Yeah, it could be interesting, I don't know who all is involved, but Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, who are Simpsons writers, longtime Simpsons writers, are also involved. So, I think it's good to be enthusiastic about it.
Yeah,
I'm very curious about what these questions are going to answer. And Futurama, of course, is unfortunately wrapped up. Simpsons is still going strong. It just became the longest-running series ever in terms of total episode count, which is 600. Yeah, back in April.
Above Coronation Street?
I think of American Broadcast.
American Broadcast.
So 636, which is more than Gunsmoke, which was the longest episode, the longest-running show. Mm-hmm. Gunsmoke, of course, ran for 20 seasons and crammed 636 episodes into that.
Quality's gone down, but that's also because Matt Groening isn't as involved with it, right? Or that could be one of the reasons.
Well, it could be also be that the show's been on for almost 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. Conan O'Brien, one thing I've been thinking about, Conan O'Brien, like, no offense, because I love his show Conan, TBS, but like I just said, it's TBS, so he's not getting that many viewers. So it'd be cool if he goes back and writes for Matt Groening in this, like he did for the first 9 of Simpsons.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping for.
I do wonder how they'll work in the celebrity cameos
because
they had the head in jars for Futurama.
Yeah.
And
when The Simpsons.
The Simpsons can
especially
just.
Especially currently.
Yeah, Simpsons, anybody can just show up.
Yeah.
That's the most, there are a lot of really great Simpsons cameos. And you know, one of my favorites of all time, though, has to be the Mel Gibson one. But it's hard to love that one because of, you know, what happened with Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
But that's another thing I'll be interested in seeing is how they work
cameos.
In the cameos. Yeah.
They won't be able to play themselves. So they'll just be, different characters, which could be quite funny.
Or,
I think it'll be more comedian cameos or comedic actor cameos.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. It's... I do notice there's also a lot of British voice actors aside from just the people he's recruited to play the main characters and also the people from Futurama. But if you look at further in the cast list, there's a lot of British people who aren't necessarily have a lot of voice acting experience. So he's trying to create that, like, quote-unquote medieval authenticity where anything set in medieval times, regardless of where it is, Everyone has a British accent. So.
He wants to get more immersed, I guess.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yes, we will see.
I got a lot of hopes.
I got a lot of hopes, too. One wonders if we'll have hopes for this. But Jared Leto, it was announced this week, he's been cast as Mobius the Living Vampire, which is another spin-off in the Spider-Man universe. It's going to be another Spider-Man movie without Spider-Man, like the upcoming Venom, starring Tom Hardy. And it seems like this kind of followed a similar course to that, where they said, we're going to make this film about a Spider-Man villain without Spider-Man. They managed to get a big star in Venom. It was Tom Hardy. In this, it's like Jared Leto.
Yeah.
And they've been able to, like, build a project around that idea. My question is, like we said at the top, like, how is Jared Leto going to get into character? Because this is the guy who, like, as the Joker, getting into the Joker character, sending dead rats to castmates and used condoms and, you know.
I didn't see Suicide Squad. Would you say he did a good role as the Joker? I think a lot of people were disappointed that he was in it less than they thought.
A lot of people were disappointed that there wasn't a lot of Joker in it. But then again, I don't like the interpretation of the character in that movie.
Okay.
I think he did fine, but I didn't like the interpretation.
He was more of a, like, wild and crazy and, like, comedic almost Joker.
That wasn't what I had a problem with. I had a problem with, like, all the, like, the gangbang euphemisms, like the, like, having tattoos all over
his face.
He was too
gangster and thug, that's not what the Joker is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it could be the same for this. It's just, honestly, I think, like you said, he's like a character actor. It just depends on how he goes about it. Maybe if he's currently immersed himself already in the character, he'll be able to get there and be of a high quality for, what is it? Is it Mobius or Morbius?
It might be Morbius.
I think I put Morbius, so if it's Morbius, yeah.
Fact check.
Honestly, Jared Leto aside, I'm just surprised this is going to be a film.
No, you're right, Morbius. I'm thinking of Mobius, the comic book artist.
Yeah, yeah. I've never heard of him.
Morbius. I'm familiar from the 90s when they tried to make a super team out of all the supernatural characters, so like Ghost Rider and Morbius and Doctor Strange and... there were a couple other like Blade. There were a couple other characters in there, and there was also an arc on the Spider-Man animated series with Morbius.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I know the character. But I mean, it's a character that's been around in the comics for a long time. I think it goes back to like issue 101 in Amazing Spider-Man.
I think. I hope it's not ridiculously connected to Venom, because I think part of the problem with Suicide Squad is it wasn't just a Joker film. There was a bunch of else going on, like, you know, Will Smith's character and everything. So I think for this, if it's just a standalone film, I think it could be good. I think it could be like a high quality standalone superhero film like The Punisher, like the 90s Punisher.
The Dolph Lundgren one?
Yeah, I think so. I thought it was really good. All right. Here's a better example. The Liam Neeson film where he's like a pseudo-villain superhero. Do you know which one I'm talking about? It's from the 90s?
Oh, Darkman.
Darkman, yeah.
Yeah, I like Darkman.
I think it could be like that. I think it could be like Darkman.
All right.
Yeah, we'll or Blade. Not Blade 2 and 3, but the first Blade.
You don't like Blade 2?
Okay, not Blade 3.
All right.
But, yeah.
All right. Good enough. We'll have to have that out later. In the meantime, we are going to... take up next our review of Sicario: Day of the Soldado to set the tone. Well, not really to set the tone, because this is going to be pretty upbeat. But this is Juan Luis Guerra, and from his album Colección Cristina. I'm not sure. My Spanish sucks. But this is the song Soldado, and it is going to be remarkably upbeat given the movie review next. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Soldado de voz y trompeta, oh, oh, oh. Aleluya, soldado de guerra,
¿cómo?
No rules this time. Turning you loose. How loose? Carlos Reyes. How's that for loose? It's your chance to get even for your family. You're gonna help us start a war.
With who?
Everyone.
No, that wasn't Thane I was talking. Well, what's the actor play something else? But anyway, different movie. That was a clip from Sicario: Day of the Soldado. And it's the new film from Stefano Solomia. He stars James Brolin, Benicio Del Toro, Catherine Keener, Isabella Moner, and Jeffrey Donovan. And I think for those of us who saw Sicario way back when, well, not way back when, it's like 3 years ago, but this is a very different movie from that first Sicario in a number of different ways. And I think there was a kind of pragmatism in Sicario that wasn't necessarily cynical. But I think in Day of the Soldado, it's kind of deeply cynical in a way that like 24 was very cynical. And I don't think that's very complimentary, because, you know, watching the first like 20 minutes of the thing unfold, it seemed like the first episode of a new season of 24, with like getting the layout of all these new characters and this like terrorist threat. It starts with a suicide bombing at a grocery store, and you're meant to think the cartel is in Mexico are bringing these guys across the border.
Quick scene in Somalia too, just to quickly talk about what's going on there.
Which, if you don't know your geography, is from the opposite side of the world, from where the U.S.-Mexican border. That was the thing about that first film. There was like this very clear focus on this one issue on
the border
with the drug trafficking. And this one is kind of all over the place with human trafficking and terrorism and migrant and border enforcement policy. And it
just all the crazy stuff that the cartel is doing.
Right. And none of it, I think, deals with – not that the movie has to deal with like what's happening right now on the U.S.-Mexican border. But, I mean, it's almost about 5 years too late that this is kind of the focus of a story. Not to say that the problems have been solved with Mexican cartels, because certainly that's what's driving a lot of migrants up to the U.S.-Mexican border. Mm-hmm. But I think the right hand of doom in the form of, you know, Benicio Del Toro's hitman character is, I'm not sure.
It's more singular focused on his character, I would say, than the first one was.
Yeah.
And it's more, not more fun, but they tried to make it more fun.
Right.
I was trying to think of another good example, but it's more like Expendables than the first one. This one, they realized that people, they loved how in-depth the story was in the first one, but mainly people love that action. So there's a lot of that in this. Some of it, I would say, a bit too over the top. And as you were saying, there isn't as much of a solidified plot.
Yeah.
Like, there's no kind of singular issue that they're dealing with.
Right. Well, in the first Sicario, the first time I watched it, I was like, so what are they doing? What's going on? And it's kind of not revealed until the final scene. Like, this was the whole plot the whole time. And the Emily Blunt character, who's not in this one, wasn't made aware of that. You know, she thought it was for all the, you know, the right reasons, and it turned out there was this kind of whole separate mission going on to install the Del Toro character, whose name's Alejandro, as a kind of, you know, crime figure to sort of take apart the cartels from the inside, or at least create stability from the inside. And this one, it's...
They reveal, like, at that point, like you said, that he's the Sicario. He's the hitman. Like, that's what he is. He doesn't work for the CIA.
Right. And then in this one, there's still some of that, but it's kind of made kind of blatant at the beginning that this is what they're doing, that they're trying to create a war between the cartels so they can destabilize them.
Yeah, we played the clip for that.
Yeah.
It's literally just Josh Brolin in the beginning saying, what is it that he says?
Yeah, we're going to start a war
with everyone. Going to start a war. So he explains it at the beginning instead of like in the first one where it's near the end. Because that's what the film is. They're literally just, it's just a war. The cartels and Alejandro.
Right. At that, though, the plan is kind of never really clear to me because they go to Mexico, they kidnap a cartel boss's daughter, bring her back to the U.S., and they're going to take her back like, hey, we found your daughter, and or something. And then it becomes a thing where the policy is they give up on the policy and Alejandro becomes public enemy number one. Mm-hmm. And it's like and so you kind of get to the end of this and you're like, so what was all that about? Because there is a lack of focus.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm not just saying this to defend it because I like Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro, but I think they partially did that on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Because both those characters don't really know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Josh Brolin doesn't know what to do because Benicio del Toro is like a close friend, right? But he has to listen to the U.S. government. And Benicio del Toro, after losing a wife and a kid, he just doesn't know what's going on, right? And especially with the girl that we were just talking about, that changes everything for him.
Right.
Because he wants to, in the first one, I don't want to spoil the first one, but this child changes his opinion and views of what he wants to do. So there's confusion. Josh Brolin's confused. Benicio del Toro's confused. And I think that's why the viewers aren't 100% sure what they're doing and what their singular goal is.
Mm. I don't want to make it sound like I'm knocking down this movie because I think it's in terms of a regular action movie and it's above par.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, above par. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. But I think in terms of the difference between – you hate to compare – a sequel to an original, but it comes from the same screenwriter. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously a continuation of the story and the ideas he has. But one of the things I kind of found out in reading more about this movie is that they actually reworked Taylor Sheridan's script. So that seems to be worse. I think that's the root of a lot of the story confusion in this, is that it's
reworking that they didn't fully perfect.
The first half of the script is going in this one direction, and then that's kind of stops in the halfway through because the producer and the directors had different ideas of what direction it was going to go in, and so it loses that kind of focus and it loses that kind of flow. And if they wanted to make it a movie about how Alejandro in this position that they've put him in has kind of gone too far, and they wanted to set a stage between having him fight the Brolin character.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been interesting, but that's the movie they seem to be. I don't know if they seem to be setting it up for the next one, for
either
Sicario 3, but
a mysterious type of conclusion,
right? But why set up for part three what you can do in part two? And that's a problem I've had with a lot of movies.
I don't know if they could have done it in the sequel. If you're talking about like the very, very end.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that has to do with this that I want to mention, the one thing I loved about this, Sicario 2, and that I actually preferred to the first one, is there was a whole, throughout the whole 2 hours, 2 hour, 5 minutes, a singular storyline by a young Latin American U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And what that leads to.
That kind of annoyed me, actually.
Really? That annoyed you? See, that some people... Yeah, I guess it depends on the
Because we
the
kept
person.
Going back to this kid, and it's like, I know this is leading somewhere.
But I didn't know where, so that's why I kept up with it. That's why I focused on it.
It was such a... Well, it wasn't a deus ex machina, but it was definitely this, like, hey, look at this kid.
Yeah.
You'll be learning more about him in the future. And that kind of irks me, unless it can be like sort of more organically weaved into the story.
Okay. I thought it flowed well with it. But
but
I can see why a lot of people wouldn't.
I mean, the way it was worked in was kind of problematic. Although what I will notice, again, and it kind of goes to the broader themes in real life, is that he lives in McAllen, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where a lot of the migrant separation stuff is, because there's a big detention center for the separated children in McAllen. So, you know, when I saw that come up, that title card come up, it says McAllen, Texas. That was my thoughts. Like, oh, I know where that's from and where that is and why that's and matters in real life. But yeah, I mean, that could have, again, that could have opened up some interesting opportunities. But
I think if there is a third one, it has opened up some.
Yeah, but I think there are whole portions of this we could have skipped over, and if that was where we were getting to, with a kind of showdown between the Brolin character and the Del Toro character, you know, I think the idea is like you can create a monster, but can you control the monster?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems bizarre that after everything that happened in the first Sicario, that, you know, they're kind of still, there's still a kind of camaraderie between them that, you know, because what the first end of the first Sicario made clear was that Alejandro was a useful tool.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point was like to use the tool the way he wants to be used and the way he's of benefit to the American side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just how kind of morally bankrupt that is. And the flip side of that, too, was that the one morally upstanding character in that film, which was the Emily Blunt FBI agent, eventually goes along with it and signs off on it, even though she clearly has some misgivings. Mm-hmm. But she eventually just, like, signs her name to be done with it. And, you know, there's a statement there, like, we hate these horrible things being done in our name, but we tacitly agree with them because the other ideas are harder, or, you know, the problem's too big to wrap your head around. So you go for the short term solutions, and that's the kind of subtlety I think was missing in the film.
Yeah, it's hard for me to say because I'm the kind of guy that likes there being a couple little questions left. One thing I also do want to say, was it Emily
Blunt?
Emily Blunt, that's what I thought. I'm totally okay she wasn't in the sequel. I can see why a lot of people would be upset with that. But her character, like you just said, she was good.
Mm-hmm.
She was a good person. She didn't like what was going on. She didn't agree with Brolin. And I didn't like that. I didn't like it. It actually made it feel, in my opinion, more like a basic film where there's one good person and she's good the whole time, right? Her and the Get Out actor, Daniel Kaluuya.
Yeah.
So I preferred in the sequel how there was just kind of madness all over the place, and the whole time you're wondering, like, is Brolin like good in any way? Is there any good in Benicio del Toro's character?
Mm-hmm.
So there's more questions, and there was more screen time of just Brolin and Benicio del Toro.
I don't think, I'm fine with Emily Blunt not being in this, mm-hmm. either. It's not her story,
but I guess not being able to adapt fully to a character made it so there's not as many feelings that you can get through, a powerful feelings that you can get through watching the sequel.
I'm not sure she was good the whole time, because there were very clear indications at different points in the film that she wanted to be more involved.
But only if Alejandro, Benicio del Toro's character, like, you know, puts a gun up at her or something like that.
Right. Well, yeah, but I mean, there's a difference between temptation and and giving into that temptation, though. And I think there's certainly temptation in that, because she's the FBI agent. She's technically the one responsible for the whole operation.
Yeah.
But there are things that are being done under her supervision that, you know, she's basically just being made a mascot for. And she's torn between wanting to, you know what's in all the dark corners because it's her responsibility, and not wanting to know what's going on in the dark corners, because in the end, it's basically sanctified for people with a higher pay grade than her. So how do you navigate, you know, your own personal moral code when the moral code of those who are supposed to be responsible for you is so compromised? we're talking more about Sicario than Sicario 2.
Well, because it has to do with it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, I like Del Toro a lot. I think he's really great in the role. He's, like...
100%.
He's very menacing. I think they almost humanize him too much. And
you think so? You think he should be even crazier?
I think...
You should think there should have been a bit more violence?
I think that the way it's understood at the end of that film is that he's unhinged and he's become a monster, and they're going to use the monster the way the only way they can, which is to have some semblance of control on him by basically tacitly rubber stamping the things he does. And in this movie, there's a scene of him with a farmer who's deaf, and they're signing to each other, and because his daughter was deaf, so he
and that was cool. There was more of a look into the Mexican side of the border in this one.
That was interesting.
That was interesting, too. Yeah.
That was interesting.
And I'm not going to lie. When I was watching the first one, I thought El Dorado. Not El Dorado. Where is it set? I think El Dorado.
El Paso?
El Paso. Sorry. Yeah.
El Dorado is a very different place.
Yeah. It's a fictional place. Yeah. A fantastic film. But anyways, I thought that was in Mexico.
Right.
So for like a lot of the film, I just thought it was in Mexico. I was wondering how are they doing this, but it was in the States. And it shows how many people are able to cross the border because it looks more like Mexico than it does of a lot of the United States.
Well, I mean, there was the scene where the kid who becomes the mule or the coyote is like sitting by the river with his cousin, and they're watching like the migrants trying to struggle to get across the river. And I thought that's interesting because the way we kind of see this covered on the news, it's this big problem that needs to be solved. Mm-hmm. But the seeing it from that level just shows it as, you know, something that happens
more
every
realistic.
Day. You can go down to the river and watch the people trying to illegally cross.
Yeah, you relate
the
more
United
to the
States.
People that are breaking the law and crossing the United States.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the film shows like it's to be determined how much it's true, but it shows like what an operation it is and what a cash cow it is for. People of a certain level of criminality to charge these people $1,000 a head to sneak them into the United States and what a business it is. It's not just about people running for their lives or about people wanting to build a better life for themselves, but it's also about there's also a business end to it.
Yeah, the cartel's not just helping to be nice and let people go to the United States. Like, they're doing it for their own reasons. They're doing it for money.
Right.
So it
And I mean, and seeing that kind of infrastructure is interesting. I don't know. It just seems like a different side to it. And maybe that's where Sheridan comes in, or where some of Sheridan's stuff comes in, because it seems like in the second half of the film, that stuff kind of goes right out the window in favor of big gunfights and terrible violence and all this stuff about the government. That was the thing that was kind of unbelievable to me, is there's a scene where there's this shootout with the federal police in Mexico, and the government's like, okay, so we took the gloves off, but we didn't know how messy it was going to be, even though there was a whole scene with like the Secretary of Defense who's like, you get as messy as you want, as messy as you have to get this done. And then like after one, I don't know if it was botched or not, but like after one bad, like messy incident, they're like, okay, too messy. And it just, there's such an indecisiveness on the part of the Americans. And
it shows how hard Brolin's job is, you know? Going along with that though, the guy who was telling them, oh, that's too much, that's not enough. I don't think in this one, in comparison to the first one, there was as much of the CIA, like seeing the people just sitting at their desks. There wasn't as much of a realistic glimpse into the CIA dealing with it all, at least I found.
Well, in so much as any of this can be realistic in terms of the CIA. That whole thing just kind of struck false to me, that that kind of gets into the 24-iness of it. Terrorists are bad and we have to do absolutely anything, which is something that's almost that idea has been around for 20 years.
At the same time though, the director is an immigrant himself,
right?
So that's why, another reason why I think it was more kind of, is this good, is this bad? There's no right or wrong expressed through the film.
No, and it's just the ideas of it that you have to do anything and everything possible to claim. It just seems like an idea that's 10 years passe. There's a reason why 24 comes back and it doesn't work anymore. It's because a lot of the ideas that were inherited in that, like things like torture and doing anything necessary and sacrificing people, on a whim. It's not where the consciousness of where we are at now. So the beginning just kind of strikes a false chord. Once we kind of get into the Brolin stuff and the Del Toro stuff, the movie sort of sets into its rhythms.
Mm-hmm, its proper rhythm.
Yeah, and even the back half of the film, which is problematic, there is still kind of a flow to it. They kind of write off the terrorist stuff. There's like a line about, oh, they were actually from New Jersey. They weren't brought across the border. So it's like even the movie makers were bored with this whole idea right from the get-go. But I think
Yeah, there are certain things that just did not need to be in it.
Yeah, there's a... Again, and it sounds like we're kind of beating up on the movie more maybe than we intend, certainly than I intend, because it kept my attention the whole time. I found it very engaging. There was great tension into it. And, you know, I was here alone for Jurassic World last week. But I appreciate the embarrassed laugh. But the thing that film was missing was tension.
Yeah, exactly.
That, you know, the whole thing where they arrive on the island and the volcano just erupts and just stuff happens and there's no build-up. And in this, there's significant build-up. And you know,
relate to these characters.
Right, and in a scene where you're driving along the highway, even though you're in a Humvee and you're relatively protected, you're just waiting for something to happen. Mm-hmm. And there's people talking to each other on walkie-talkies and they're checking their perimeters, and you got Apache helicopters flying overhead, you know.
Along with the helicopters, another positive, just like in the first one, I think the cinematography is fantastic.
There's
so many realistic helicopter shots. Like, they're probably, you know, using drones or whatever, but just really good glimpse into how bland the border landscapes are and, you know, like Texas and stuff, and how people get across the border.
Yeah, the cinematography is really good. The music, I thought, was really good.
Yeah, exactly.
Hildur Guano de Tir is the composer who... He didn't do the music on the first one. That was Denis Villeneuve's regular composer.
Yeah, different director, different writer and everything, right?
No, the writer's the same. Writer's it's still the same. Taylor Sheridan.
But you said he edited it. They edited his...
They changed
this one
his
a bit
script.
More. Yeah.
Which makes me sad because, like, Taylor Sheridan's been 3 out of 3. Mm-hmm. He wrote Sicario. He wrote To Hell and Back. And he wrote Wind River, which are 3 very good scripts. And so I'm not sure who the director thought he was. He had to rewrite Taylor Sheridan, but he did. but it's I will say that there's the action is good, the tension is good, the character work is good. I feel like this is. If this had been called something else and not Sicario, like if it had been just called Soldado and it was unrelated to stuff that happened.
It would have been even better, you think?
I think I would have been able to forgive things a bit easier.
I think it would have gotten more critical attention too, more positive reviews.
Right, because the thing is, it's not, again, it's not going the place where Sicario left us. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have the same... the same tone of Sicario, and they didn't have to. The whole thing could have, you know, we've seen things from the government side. They could have done one from the cartel side with Alejandro as the full main character, infiltrator, and then had like Brolin coming in. But the whole thing is kind of from Brolin's point of view, and I'm not sure he's the most interesting character in this scenario.
Yeah, and the daughter of the main cartel leader, do you ever even see the main cartel leader?
No.
So, you know, there's that too.
Which is...
There is a lot missing.
Which is the weird part because that's the guy, as we played in the clip, who Alejandro is...
Is after.
Is after.
Yeah.
So that's not even squared off.
Yeah. So now, after what you said, I do think there probably was some writing issues.
Yeah.
I do think they probably edited his a bit too... They didn't do a good job of it. Of editing it. I think he did a great job of writing it because the film is still high quality.
I think the film is good. It's better than what we deserve.
Yeah, I think you described it in the best way. It's above. It's a tiny bit above the par of most straight-up action films.
Yeah.
But it still is an action film. It's not a drama. It's just
the action film version of Sicario.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the best way to describe it.
Cool. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll leave that there.
Yeah, a lot of But there was a lot of negatives, that we said. But I do just, because of all the negatives, I just want to, my last thing to be, it's great. I think you should go see it. Even if you haven't seen the first, I went with my partner and she hadn't seen it. So I think most people should go see it. Even though, if you're listening to this, we talked a lot about its negatives.
Yeah, but it's I think it's still interesting. It's still got its satisfactory parts, and Del Toro is great, and it's worth watching.
As per usual.
And definitely the first Sicario is definitely worth checking out, finding it on streaming or
it's on Netflix. Yeah, just watch it. Watch it right now.
Oh, is it
now.
On Netflix?
Yeah, it's on Netflix where I watched it.
Great. So there you go.
Yeah. It's,
not only can you find it, you can find it easy. Mm-hmm. And we're going to call it a wrap for this week's episode of the show. You can find us on End Credits. Website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media on Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, and End Credits Radio on the Twitter. And Peter, where can people find more of you on
Mr. the internet? Mr. Talrak on Twitter and YouTube.
The good old Mr. Talrak site. And before we go, I do want to remind everyone that Tim's play, one of our co-hosts here, Tim Phillips, he has a play at Toronto Fringe called The Joy of Sax, and its first performance is tomorrow at Theatre Passé Mural at the Main Space. You can find more information on that or tickets, and you can buy tickets at fringetoronto.com, and it plays all through next week as well. And so if you're in Toronto, check it out, and check out other stuff at Fringe, but mostly Tim's play because, you know, he's a friend and co-host.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. For News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz there. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll see you back here Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits. And we'll see you then.